What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Play plays a significant role in early childhood development. It provides kids an avenue to learn how to interact and communicate with others. It teaches them how to develop skills necessary throughout life. Joining me via phone from the Chicago area, I welcome Ann Gadzikowski, author of Creating a Beautiful Mess, 10 Essential Play Experiences for a Joyous Childhood. Ann, welcome to 411 Teen.
Thank you. I'm so happy to have a chance to speak with you today.
Looking forward to the information you can share with my listening audience. Initially, what was the impetus for you writing Creating a Beautiful Mess?
Well, I became interested in writing the book because in my work with children and families, I was hearing a lot of questions from parents about play, about children's play, especially related to technology. Because, you know, we see children, really young children now, who are interested in playing computer games on tablets and on smartphones. And I think a lot of parents and grandparents and teachers and a lot of adults are wondering, what does that mean for children's play and development? And do children still play the way they used to? And the book is reassuring parents that play is still play. Children do still need the same things that they've always needed. And there's a place for technology, but there are a lot of other great play experiences that make up a balanced childhood.
So am I correct in saying that your book is really for adults, not just parents, but anyone who's interested or interacts with children?
Yeah, I think the book is a really hopeful, positive book about the joy of play. So anyone who has contact with children, a babysitter or an aunt or an uncle, or even people who enjoy playing themselves. There are some great tips in the book about board games that are good for people of all ages. So, you know, anyone who feels like they need more play in their life, I think it's a good choice for them.
And most all of us need that. What's the significance of the title, Creating a Beautiful Mess?
Well, you know, when I was working with my editor and the publisher, Red Leaf Press, on finalizing the book, we were thinking about what would make a good title. And one of the chapters of the book, Chapter 6, is called Creating a Beautiful Mess, because that's the chapter about playing with Play-Doh and finger paint and making mud pies and sandbox play and all that really ooey-gooey, messy play is creating a beautiful mess. But we realized that all play is beautiful and messy in one way or another, and that would make a great title for the book.
Yeah, it was so appropriate. As we get into play and examine and explore it, what is play?
Well, I think there are a lot of different ways to define play, but I like to think of it really broadly, that play can be anything that you do that's purely for the joy or the pleasure of it. So it's not work, it's not studying, it's not a specific goal-directed thing. There's an openness and a freedom to play, especially in the play of young children.
And even though we say the play of young children, I think you alluded to this earlier, play can be at any level and is necessary at all levels.
Yeah, I think play is really necessary for human development, that it's restful. You know, it gives your brain a break from the other important things that you're doing. And it's also a real connector between people. And I write about that a lot in Creating a Beautiful Mess. This is a way that parents connect with their children, show their children that they really value the time that they spend together.
As you look at play today and play yesterday, how has play changed from your perspective in the last 10 to 15 years even?
Well, I looked at that pretty carefully when I was researching the book, because I get a lot of questions about, what is the influence of technology and what are children missing out on when they're playing computer games? And there are a couple of key areas of play that we don't see as often now that we probably saw 10 or 15 years ago. One of those is block play. Also, another area is outdoor play. Children are not getting outdoors and playing as actively as they used to. And then another key area that I was very interested in was the collecting behaviors of children, collecting stamps and coins and rocks and seashells and those kinds of things. We see that children aren't doing as much of that now as they used to. So in the book, I look at a couple of those factors and really examine how we can make sure that they're still really important parts of children's lives.
Do you find that play today limits creativity, particularly when we're talking about digital play and cell phones and smartphones and computers?
I think that parents have to be really picky about the kinds of games and apps and websites that they choose for their children, because there are so many now, and it can be really overwhelming to make those choices. So there are some games that are very repetitive, that don't open up the children to new ideas, but there are some really terrific computer games that are very creative, that allow children to make up their own stories or make up their own songs. Those are the kinds of experiences that we want children to have. So when parents are making those choices, or really any of us when we're making those choices, there are some very trusted experts who can guide us. And one of the resources I steer parents to in the book and my work is a website called Common Sense Media, and it's a nonprofit organization. They publish reviews of apps and computer games for families, and I think it's a really great way for parents to check out the games that their children are playing and make sure that they're really, you know, productive and fun games for their kids.
Would you mention that name one more time, just for the listening audience?
Yeah, so it's called Common Sense Media, and the website is commonsensemedia.org.
Okay. Sensory play has been identified as so very important, particularly when looking at early development, sensory play and experimentation. Why is this such an important component?
Yeah, the sensory play, when we say sensory play, we're talking about engaging all the senses, or as many of the senses as we can. So it's not just visual, but children are touching things and moving things. And in the case of Play-Doh and finger paints, that's a very sensory experience in terms of the textures that the children feel with their hands. With really young children, it's so important because this is how they learn about their world, and this is how they learn about their bodies, how their hands work. They're gaining strength in their fingers when they're playing with clay. So it's exploratory because that's how children learn. They construct their knowledge from the experiences that they're having in the world. And if that's a little messy, then, you know, I advise parents, then do it outdoors. Then go to the park and play in the sandbox at the park. Or, you know, on a rainy day, make sure you have those rubber boots on so you can splash in the puddles. And that's how we're going to learn about the properties of liquids and solids. There's a lot of science learning. There's a lot of learning about nature that goes on when children have those really messy hands-on experiences.
But it seems like today we're geared toward not being messy and keeping everything in order and straight. So how do parents avoid these types of pitfalls?
Yeah, I really think parents need to relax. Mm-hmm. Being a parent is a tough job. And when I walk through a bookstore and I see all the parenting books, so often these books are warning parents about all the horrible things that could happen to their child. I think parents need to be affirmed and they need to relax. And I think most people know how to be a good parent. They just need to slow down. So the book is a hopeful book, Creating a Beautiful Mess. It's a reminder to parents of the things that they enjoyed, things that you enjoy when you were a child, that you can still do those things with your child. And a little goes a long way. I'm not telling parents that they need to cancel, you know, all their plans and just sit on the floor and play with blocks all day. You can do that for a little while and then do some chores, then put the laundry in, come back and, you know, do a little bit more. So a balanced childhood, a balanced family is the primary message of the book.
Overall, do you think children play enough today? And I mean really by your definition of play, where it's spontaneous, it's not directed. Are they getting enough play today?
I don't think so. And, you know, since the book has been published in August, I've been talking to a lot of parents and teachers about play, and what I'm hearing is that they're not. And I think we have some research and data to show that children are spending less time in recess. You know, the school day is longer. Their time outside of school is more structured with lessons and tutoring and other kinds of, structured activities. So I really would encourage parents to try to protect some unscheduled time for their children. And I don't write about homework in the book, but I've been asked about it a lot since the book came out. And I do believe that generally children are getting too much homework, and that the time that they spend at home with their families in the evenings and on weekends should be a joyful time for families to be together, and that there's a little bit too much emphasis on the rote learning that goes into homework.
In your book, you comment how play is universal. Would you elaborate on that?
Well, the children will play whether we let them or not.
Exactly.
You know, we are born knowing how to play. We are born knowing how to pretend and how to stack things and how to collect things. So a lot of what I advise parents to do is to allow the children to follow their natural wisdom as far as play is concerned. So, and we still know how to play. I mean, I think adults have so much nostalgia around the memories we have of play from our childhood, and we want our children to have those same experiences, and they can. I think it has to do with, you know, as I said, protecting a little unstructured free time so that these kinds of play experiences can develop.
How much should adults play with children?
Well, it depends on the age of the child, because when they're really little, you know, when they're toddlers or they're preschoolers, the children are going to ask their parents to play with them. You'll hear this inevitably with the young kids. They'll say, play with me, Mommy, play with me, Daddy. They'll want you to, you know, have a tea party with them, or they'll want you to, you know, play with blocks with them. And that's the time when they need it, when they're asking for it. That's when they really want to engage. When the children get older, then naturally they're going to be more interested in what their friends are doing and what other kids are doing. And then it's a little bit harder for parents to find a place and a time to play with their children.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen. This hour we're looking at play. We're going to take a break, but we'll return momentarily. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. My guest is Ann Gadzikowski, who has more than 25 years of experience working in the field of early childhood education as a teacher and a school administrator. Ann, I had to interrupt you when you were just talking about how much time, how adults should play with children. Did you want to finish your comment?
Well, I was thinking about when children get older and their friends and their peers become more important to them, there's still a place for parents to play with their children. It's still an important family and bonding experience. And in the book, there are a couple of chapters later in the book where I talk about the play of older children. And board games, card games is one category that families of, you know, all different age, family members of all different ages can play together. And then I also write about collecting things, building a collection of, you know, baseball cards or Pokemon cards or, you know, souvenirs from trips. That's another kind of playful activity that older kids can still do with their parents.
As we look at play, what influence does society have on play? And I'm thinking about dictating what kids play with, where they play with it, when they play with it, at what stage they should play with a particular toy. Do you see that society plays a role?
I think that where I see that a lot has to do with the kinds of toys that are marketed to children. And that's where I get a lot of questions from parents. You know, you walk into a toy store and you see a lot of action figures and dolls that are based on TV shows and movies. There are, you know, these brands or these, you know, really popular items that parents wonder, is, you know, is this okay for my child to play with? They feel pressure from all the commercials to buy a certain thing for their children. And, you know, again, I would take a balanced perspective. These items aren't going to hurt your child. There's nothing wrong with buying them a special toy for Christmas or birthday if it's something that they really want. But I also encourage parents to have to think critically about the kinds of toys that you're bringing into your home, and to think about having a few items like wooden blocks or even cardboard boxes that are really open-ended, that the child can create something of their own imagination from. Drawing, pretend play, there are a lot of ways that children play where they're creating their own stories and not necessarily recreating the ones that they see on television.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll get a lot of those ideas from books. So taking your child to the library, picking out some good storybooks that you can read together, that's going to inspire their play more so than that trip to the toy store.
You've referred to building blocks several times. Why are building blocks so important? And they're important, yet we seem to see less of them. At least, you know, I seem to see less of them. Maybe it's just me. And then the ones that you see are very structured. I mean, I'm talking about building blocks that you just put together, the child puts together at their own initiative, that mm-hmm. don't have curves and don't have, you know.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so why are building blocks so important?
Well, I am a huge block advocate.
Okay.
And one of the reasons I've become so passionate about blocks is because the teaching that I do and the curriculum that I develop with kids in my regular job is around science, technology, engineering, and math,
uh-huh.
or what we call STEM learning. And that kind of really advanced and high-level thinking I'm seeing comes from the children's experience with hands-on construction
mm-hmm.
materials like blocks and Legos and cardboard boxes and all those other things. But children need to be holding these items in their hands, not just looking at pictures on a screen. That's how they'll learn the properties. That's how they'll learn about gravity. That's how they'll learn about balance and symmetry. They have to build the tower and the tower has to fall down. That's how they're going to find out about what makes a strong foundation. So I think there's so much learning that goes on when children are engaged in these kinds of open-ended construction activities. And I don't see wooden blocks as much. And I don't have anything against plastic bricks like Legos, but when they click together,
mm-hmm.
they're not having as authentic an experience about what makes something strong when you're building it. If you're using a plain old brick or a plain old block, you're going to learn a lot more about how that brick stacks and how you can build a strong structure than you would if you were using plastic.
Well, I tell you, I look at building blocks, and they're sort of a multitask play experience, in that with building blocks, they touch on all the things you were talking about. I mean, there's math, there's engineering, there's design in there, there's geometry in there. I mean, there's all those different things in the building blocks, so I certainly understand what you're saying. Do you have any recommendations on what types of blocks for young parents or grandparents or whomever to purchase?
Well, I mentioned that I do like the wooden blocks
mm-hmm.
more than the plastic blocks, especially when children are really young. There's something about a wooden block. It has a nice weight to it. It fits in the hand really nicely. It's a natural material, so it is a sensory experience for the children, the texture of the wood. It's smooth, but it's not slippery like plastic
mm-hmm.
can be. So it's a really authentic material for children to build with. And a good set of wooden blocks will grow with the child. It's something that you could introduce to your child when they're 2 or 3 years old, and they will probably keep playing with that all the way through 5, 6, even 7 years old, adding other materials to it. So they're creating pretend scenarios using little figures or dolls or using little cars, and they're creating, you know, more elaborate cities. So as they get older, they'll use the blocks differently. So it's a toy that grows with the children. And having a good set of wooden blocks, if you have a lot of good plain old bricks, like the rectangles that children really enjoy building with, those are the most important pieces because that's going to build the strongest structure. You don't need a lot of the fancy pieces to build some really creative structures with.
Now, I know you touched on this, but what about Legos? I know that they have served their purpose, but to a certain degree, they don't offer the creativity that a basic wooden block does.
Yeah, I do like Legos for older kids.
Okay.
But for the younger ones, I think it's really important that they have those wooden blocks. But I've seen children up to teenagers who are very engaged with Lego structures. Some of that comes back to the marketing of the toys, because certain types of toy sets are marketed to align with a popular movie or TV show. But then there are others that are more open-ended, and you can still get a nice set of Lego bricks that's open-ended. That doesn't have to be a specific thing. So I'm always in favor of the open-ended toys that can be used in lots of different ways.
How does play, as we look at play, how does it enhance the motor skills and the eye-hand coordination?
Yeah, well, that's the beauty of that is that's going to happen naturally. You don't have to teach your child to hold a block a certain way or, you know, to exercise their hand a certain way to make their hand stronger. As they play, those things are going to happen. And I mentioned before, you know, how important it is that the structures they build, that they fall over. You know, that is also another part of the building of physical dexterity, that you learn how to balance these items, you learn how to move them, you learn how to put the peg into the hole on the pegboard. These are all really important experiences for developing the muscles, but also for developing their brains. You know, you mentioned eye-hand coordination. There's a lot of neuroscience that's happening when children are engaging with these different kinds of toys and materials.
What is risky play, and how important is it?
Well, I wrote about risky play when I wrote about outdoor play, because playground design has changed since I was a kid and since I've been a teacher. Playgrounds are safer now than they used to be because the playground surfaces are softer, and that's great. But playground equipment is not as tall as it used to be. There are more regulations now about how tall slides and jungle gyms can be. So children are not having as many diverse experiences with climbing as they used to, and they really need that. So when I wrote about risky play, I wasn't talking about children getting hurt doing really dangerous things. I was talking about opportunities to challenge themselves physically, to run as fast as they can, to climb as tall as they can, to throw rocks in a puddle and see how it splashes. And I think sometimes parents are a little too quick to say, oh, slow down or be careful. This is something children really need to do. And girls need it as much as boys. So, you know, all the children need to get outside and have more of these really active, fun experiences.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know that physical exercise, physical play is essential for health and well-being. Yet the first thing that's cut is recess, or PE. Mm-hmm. And what sense does that make?
It doesn't make any sense at all. And parents get scared by that because they hear about children's health issues, that there's a growing concerns about children's obesity and they need to get their children outside to play. And I think that sometimes that actually becomes even more difficult because of the anxiety or the concern. Well, you have to run around. You have to run around. One of the things I write about in the book is just getting outside and enjoying being in nature with your child, going for a walk and looking for the different kinds of insects or birds that you see. Don't worry so much about running fast, well, if they want to run fast, but don't worry so much about calories being burned. Worry about just being with your child and having these open-ended opportunities. And children will become more active once they have more opportunities to be outdoors, I think.
All children pretend or make-believe. How important is this particular exercise, particularly when you look at the cognitive development?
Yeah.
Is it enhanced by play and pretend play?
Yeah, I mean, the cognitive development and the pretend play really go hand in hand, because when children first begin pretending, they are pretending to be the mommy or to be the daddy. They're playing house.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're doing the things that they see in their immediate environment. So they're pretending to cook, or they're pretending to drive a car.
Wear clothes.
Yes. Put on the big shoes. But then as they get older, they start to be able to imagine and pretend things that aren't in their immediate environment, or that don't even exist. They can imagine magic. They can imagine being a wizard, or being you know, a fairy that can fly through the air. And that is a really exciting point in children's cognitive development, because now they're thinking abstractly and they're thinking symbolically and they're coming up with their own scenarios. So that's such an important time for pretend play. So again, having opportunities for children to play like that with other children, with their siblings, with their parents, having time just to pretend and make up their own stories, that's such an important part of child development.
And what do you think, what's your take on this competitive, technologically advanced world? And by that I mean, are kids losing part of their childhood? Are they growing too fast and skipping parts that are really significant?
You know, I share the concern about the impact of too much technology on the lives of young children. And I think we do need to set limits on how much time children spend engaging mm-hmm. directly with these devices, with the smartphones and the computers. But I'm also really hopeful that as children have more experiences creating their own technology,
mm-hmm.
that they'll become more active creators of technology rather than just passive, you know, users of technology. So one of the things I wrote about in Creating a Beautiful Mess is allowing children, when an opportunity arises, to take their toys apart and see how they work. Or if, you know, someone's coming to fix your washing machine, that your child might want to peek in the back and see where the motor is. And when children begin to know in an active way how things work, then the mystery is taken away. Then it's not mm-hmm. this, you know, this mysterious tablet that you push a button and something happens. They become, you know, technologically savvy in ways that they can really shape their own future. So I don't think there's anything wrong with technology in the lives of children as long as they are problem solvers rather than just passively consuming technology.
Do you have an age that you would identify? Because I've seen kids as young as 1.5, 2, playing with smartphones.
Yeah. you know, it's interesting you ask that, because just in the last couple of weeks, the American Academy of Pediatrics has begun revising some of their mm-hmm. materials about the role of technology in the lives of young children. Because their guidelines previously said that they recommended no technology, no screen time for children until they're at least 2 years old. But what's happening is that there are, in context, some appropriate uses of smartphones and tablets with really young children. And here's an example. Suppose the little baby's grandma lives, you know, two states away,
mm-hmm.
and it's, you know, grandma's birthday. You want to get that little baby on the smartphone so that she can FaceTime with grandma
right.
and, you know, wave to her grandma and say happy birthday. So that's a wonderful use of technology, when they can be looking at each other face-to-face and talking to each other. So there is a certain amount of, there are certain opportunities in context where it makes sense for the children to be engaging with technology. Mm-hmm. If it's bringing people closer together, mm-hmm. I think it's a good use of technology. But you're not going to sit them down and have them play Minecraft when they're 2 years old.
Right.
That would definitely be an inappropriate use of technology.
Right.
So I think as technology gets more sophisticated, we're going to have to keep looking at these examples and see what makes sense. But as a general rule, if it brings people closer together, it's probably a good thing.
Any suggestions that you may offer parents who navigate this early childhood development as far as the major challenges that they encounter? Do you have any suggestions you may offer them?
Well, the big messages, the big takeaways are that play is important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the children will benefit from play. I think sometimes parents will read, I should be spending time tutoring my child. I should be using flashcards to teach them letters and numbers. I want to reassure parents that when you experience these open-ended play experiences with your child, when you're pretending, when you're reading stories together, they will learn those letters and those numbers. It's all in the context of play, and it will be a very rich experience for your child. So I would say relax. Enjoy the time that you have with your children. And, if you follow your own instincts on what's fun, if you follow your own memories of what you remember as being really important play experiences from your childhood, you're probably on the right track.
We're going to take a brief break. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We are examining play. We'll return shortly. What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. Games teach children to understand and follow rules, self-regulate, listen, remember, and strategize. Ann Gadzikowski serves as an early coordinator for Northwestern's University Center for Talent Development, where she manages LeapFrog, a summer enrichment program for young children. And joins 411 Teen. And we've talked about media and the impact of media, and one media that's been around a long time and, gets a negative often is television. What role do you see television playing in early childhood development?
Well, I think television is just another type of technology.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time when we were really concerned about television in the same ways that we're concerned about iPads and smartphones
exactly.
now.
Exactly.
One of the resources that I found really helpful as a parent and as an educator is the Fred Rogers Center in Pittsburgh. And Fred Rogers was the Mr.
Yeah.
Rogers of Mr. Rogers.
Yes, yes.
And he was so well known as saying that he went into television because he hated it so much,
mm-hmm.
that he wanted to provide an alternative that was quality television for children. And he's passed away since.
Yeah.
But there is a Fred Rogers Center in Pittsburgh that's founded in his name, and it has some wonderful resources online for educators and parents about making good choices for your kids. So along with, I mentioned earlier, Common Sense Media, the Fred Rogers Center is another really good resource for making those kinds of decisions. How much television to watch, what shows are right for what age of child, and, these are decisions that parents have to make every single day.
Mm-hmm.
But you can get a little support and you can get a little guidance by some of these good organizations who are doing great work on behalf of children and families.
Well, Anne, for generations, communication has been identified as a major concern, something we always need to focus on. Why is communication an ongoing issue? Do you have any suggestions for improving our communication skills?
Oh, that is a good question. You know what comes to mind when I hear that question is how important it is for adults to stop and listen to children. That when you read parenting books or you read parenting articles, they tell you what advice you should give your kids and what you should say to your kids. But I think sometimes what's missing is reminding parents that we need to stop and listen. And sometimes I think we might be surprised by how much our children know, by how much they notice, and by how much they thrive when they know that we're listening and that we value what they have to say. And that's probably going to be a good model for them as they get older and as they learn how to be good listeners.
How can parents, and we have touched on this somewhat, encourage their children to play outside more? I say this because we've talked about Play-Doh and water play and bubbles and mud pies, playing in the sand, and how it's really important to have that true sensory experience. That interaction, that hands-on experience. And this is what has decreased, I think, over the years. As we look at play compared 10 years ago, 15 years ago, kids now, they really don't want to go outside. They don't. It's almost like you have to force them. Well, you must go outside. They would rather stay inside, and I've heard so many parents comment on that. Do you have...
I do hear that a lot.
Okay.
Well, with the really young kids, my experience is once they get out there, they enjoy it. So when they say they don't want to go outside, it's usually because they don't want to bother putting on their jacket. You know, it's the it's the transition from the inside to the outside that they find unpleasant. But once they're outside, there's more room. There are interesting things to see. They can be noisy. You know, there are so many great things about being outside that I think once we get them out there, they're going to enjoy it. And I have another trick that I would suggest, and I wrote about this in the book. When you are bringing your child outdoors, use some of this cool technology as a way of noticing and recording your experiences outdoors. So bring the tablet or the smartphone out and take pictures of some of the interesting things that you see. So the beautiful leaves that are coming off the trees onto the ground, the weather, the clouds, the birds, the insects, or if you're in a more urban area, the way the buildings are constructed. And this comes back to the block play. Like, how is that skyscraper made? Or how is that house made? How is that roof attached onto the walls? What can we notice? Let's take a picture of it with the smartphone, and when we get home, we can try to build that out of our wooden blocks. So you can make connections between that outdoor play and the indoor play so that they're kind of inspiring each other.
Okay. And as we talk, play is just so very important. It's very significant when it comes to developing the skills that they need to thrive in today's world. And I'm thinking of things like self-confidence. How do we cultivate self-confidence in children?
When I get questions about confidence, often that has to do with girls, because generally girls are more reserved during play. Not all of them. Some girls are really confident and assertive. But especially around the construction play, the block play, the puzzles and the problem solving, I think sometimes girls and parents too might perceive those activities as being boy things and not girl things. So I encourage parents of girls in particular to make sure that they invite their daughters, invite their children to have the same kinds of opportunities with Legos and with wooden blocks or with board games or some of the more challenging kind of science and math-oriented activities so that they can develop the same experiences and the same knowledge and the same confidence that boys have. So that's one thing that comes to mind when you talk about confidence in play.
So, and you've mentioned this earlier also about the common childhood activity of collecting things, rocks and shells and acorns or whatever. Would you elaborate, though, for the listening audience, what benefit this whole activity plays in overall development?
That is an area that has been neglected. You just
yes,
don't
exactly.
see kids building collections like they used to. And one of the reasons why is because now we have this thing called the Internet,
uh-huh.
and if there's a special card or stamp or coin that you're collecting, you can find it on eBay in, 3 minutes. And if you have a credit card, you can
right.
just buy it. So the thrill and excitement of looking for the thing that's hard to find has been, in some ways, taken away from that process. But I want to remind parents that what young children enjoy most about collecting things is finding something in their immediate environment
mm-hmm.
that they can hold and save. So often, that isn't something special that you would buy on eBay. Often, it's a rock that has a little speck of gold in it, or it's a shell that has an interesting ridge on it. You know, there are certain things that will catch a child's eye that an adult might not even notice. And when children collect things, they feel empowered. You were talking about confidence. They
mm-hmm.
feel empowered when there's something that belongs to them, that they found themselves, and they can attach their own meaning to it. They can put it in a box. They can make a certain way of categorizing the little items that they have. They can sort them by color. They can sort them by size. You know, it's like a little world that
mm-hmm.
the child is in charge of. So collecting things is a really empowering experience for children, and I think sometimes we need to remind parents of how important that is.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult in this world, and today's world, and you've touched on that, because they can circumvent all the activities that are so important in collecting things. Okay.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Children love to tell stories. They like to tell stories in all different types of media, whether it's with words or with props. And all of this has to do with imaginative play. What is your take? Where do you sit on imaginative play?
Well, I think that when children are making up stories during play, that can happen in a couple of different ways. We sort of see that happening when we watch children play. When they're younger, say 3, 4, 5 years old, they're doing it with their own bodies because
uh-huh.
they're pretending that they are different characters. They'll be Superman or they'll be a princess. But one of the things I was really curious about when I was working on Creating a Beautiful Mess is what happens next after that. Does pretend play stop or does it turn into other things? And there were a couple of ways that I saw pretend play develop as children get older and their cognitive development continues to grow. One is that some children, drawing becomes really important. Drawing pictures
mm-hmm.
becomes a way of telling stories. And for some children, it's the play with small figures, like the superhero figures or the little collectible pet shop toys that the children will want their parents to buy for them at the store. And sometimes I think we can dismiss that as not being important because those little figures, those little plastic figures, they seem really commercialized. They're just based on TV shows. But
right.
the children usually are making up their own stories. If you really listen to what they're saying and the way they're using these toys, they're not just making a cookie cutter of what they saw
mm-hmm.
on TV. They're making it their own. And there's a lot of creativity and a lot of dialogue that goes into that kind of pretend play. So that's still really important. And some children will do that even up until, 11, 12 years old.
Okay. In your book, you talk about the cuddle toy and teaching kids about caring relationships. Is there a correlation between a cuddle toy and teaching that child about a caring relationship?
I think there is.
Okay.
Because when I watch children with their special teddy bear, their little lovey that's become so important to them, and most young children will have some kind of item that is a special attachment for them. When we see them interact with the little doll or with the little bunny, they are so gentle and caring to that object. It's almost like they're learning how to take care of their own children or their own, little baby the way they will when they get older. Or maybe it's how they'll take care of a puppy or a kitten or a gerbil when they have a real animal that's a pet of their own. So it's wonderful practice for being kind and being caring. And sometimes I think we're a little bit too quick to make children give up those special attachments. Most children will. It's a natural process of getting older. Mm-hmm. They will eventually lose interest in that teddy bear. It seems at the time like it's going to go on forever. but they will at some point be ready to put it aside. So while they have it,
let them enjoy it.
Enjoy, seeing
yeah.
how they care for that small, vulnerable animal that they want to have next to them on the pillow.
Well, you were reading my mind. I was just going to ask you, how important it is, how significant it is. But the next question, the next step I wanted to ask is, what about the significance for boys and experiencing a caring relationship and a cuddle
yes.
toy?
Yeah, because what we see from a child development point of view is that all children tend to have these attachments, a security blanket or a cuddle
mm-hmm.
toy. But unfortunately, it's the boys who are often encouraged or even forced to set them aside before
mm-hmm.
they're ready.
Indeed.
And I think we have, as a society, sometimes we have certain expectations that boys are going to be tough
mm-hmm.
or that boys are, they're not going to have, attachments like this. They're going to be strong. And those little boys need those attachments just as much as the little girls do. And perhaps they're going to grow up to become a doctor or a veterinarian.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to
Indeed.
Need that practice of taking care of something else or taking care of somebody else. So let's go ahead and encourage the boys to develop just as many caring behaviors as the girls do.
Well, in these last few minutes, let's look at the sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
Children love to laugh and giggle, and they are tickled by knock-knock jokes and, peekaboo. Talk about the sense of humor.
Yeah, I loved writing that chapter on, laughing and joking and kidding around. It's so fun to look at how a sense of humor develops from the time a child is a baby up until when they're, telling really inappropriate jokes as teenagers. There is a developmental progression that human beings go through as they develop their ability to understand a joke and to laugh and to be silly. And with the little kids, it's the slapstick humor. The 2-year-olds, the 3-year-olds, even the 4- and 5-year-olds, often that's how they learn to make friends. As parents, we take our child to the park and there are other kids there and we say, ask your friend, can I play with you? And we're teaching them these, very polite manners of how to make a friend. But really what they do is they walk up to each other and they just make a funny face. And then they're instantly friends.
They do.
They're cracking each other up. So that's how children really make friends. So it's such a valuable experience for children, and there's so much language development that goes in to learning how to tell a joke. I love telling knock-knock jokes with little kids because they'll make up their own jokes that aren't funny at all, really, when you look at, what they're actually saying. But because of how they say it and how they crack themselves up, it's hilarious.
It is.
So it's just a really important part of the natural human growth and development as children are getting older and learning how to how to be happy human beings.
Well, Anne, it's been great. I mean, you shared so much valuable information, so I appreciate it. To my listening audience, that's it for this hour. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. This edition of 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistant, Ken Smith. Audio copies are available, and if you want to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Team podcast, log in wfsu.org. Check us out on Facebook.